The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
I'm Elena Kagan, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, Bonus Edition, November 15th, 2019. Former Ambassador to Ukraine Marie Yovanovitch testified before the House Intelligence Committee as part of the impeachment investigation into the Ukraine scandal. Yovanovitch answered questions about her career, her experience in Ukraine, and her abrupt dismissal. The hearing saw some of the same grandstanding and distractions as the first public hearing. But we cut out all the unnecessary repetition and theatrics to leave you with just the questions and answers that you need to hear. It's the Lawfare Podcast Bonus Edition, Yovanovitch versus the Committee with No Bull.
We'll now move to the 45-minute rounds. I recognize myself and Majority Counsel for 45 minutes. Ambassador Yovanovitch, thank you again for appearing today. All Americans are deeply in your debt. Before I hand it over to Mr. Goldman, our staff counsel, I want to ask you about a few of the pivotal events of interest to the country. First of all, was fighting corruption in Ukraine a key element of U.S. policy and one on which you placed the highest priority?
Yes, it was.
And can you explain why?
It was important, and it was actually stated in our policy and in our strategy. It was important because corruption was undermining the integrity of the governance system in Ukraine. And as I noted in my statement, countries that have leaders that are honest and trustworthy make better partners for us. Countries where there is a level playing field for our U.S. business makes it easier for our companies to do business there, to trade, and to profit in those countries. And what had been happening since the Soviet Union, and this is very much a Soviet legacy, is that corrupt interests were undermining not only the governance but also the economy of Ukraine. We see enormous potential in Ukraine and would like to have a more capable, more trustworthy partner there.
And I know this may be awkward for you to answer since it's a question about yourself and your reputation, but is it fair to say that you earned a reputation for being a champion of anti-corruption efforts in Ukraine?
Yes. Yes.
I don't know if you had a chance to watch George Kent's testimony yesterday, but would you agree with his rather frank assessment that if you fight corruption, you're going to piss off some corrupt people?
Yes.
And in your efforts fighting corruption to advance U.S. policy interests, did you anger some of the corrupt leaders in Ukraine?
Yes.
Was one of those corrupt people Prosecutor General Yuri Lutsenko?
Yes, I believe so.
Was another one of those corrupt people Lutsenko's predecessor, another corrupt prosecutor general named Viktor Shokin?
Apparently so, although I've never met him.
At some point, did you come to learn that both Lutsenko and Shokin were in touch with Rudy Giuliani, President Trump's lawyer and representative?
Yes.
In fact, did Giuliani try to overturn a decision that you participated in to deny Shokin a visa?
Yes, that is what I was told.
And that denial was based on Mr. Shokin's corruption?
Yes, that's true.
Was it Mr. Lutsenko, among others, who coordinated with Mr. Giuliani to peddle false accusations against you as well as the Bidens?
Yes, that is my understanding.
And were these smears also amplified by the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., as well as certain hosts on Fox?
Yes. Yes, that is the case.
In the face of this smear campaign, did colleagues at the State Department try to get a statement of support for you from Secretary Pompeo?
Yes.
Were they successful?
No.
Did you come to learn that they couldn't issue such a statement because they feared it would be undercut by the president?
Yes.
And then were you told that though you had done nothing wrong, you did not enjoy the confidence of the president and could no longer serve as ambassador?
Yes, that is correct.
And in fact, you flew home from Kiev on the same day as the inauguration of Ukraine's new president?
That's true.
That inauguration was attended by three who have become known as the Three Amigos, Ambassadors Sondland, Volker, and Perry, was it?
Yes.
And 3 days after that inauguration, in a meeting with President Trump, are you aware that the president designated these three amigos to coordinate Ukraine policy with Rudy Giuliani?
Since then, I've become aware of that.
This is the same Rudy Giuliani who orchestrated the smear campaign against you?
Yes.
And the same Rudy Giuliani who, during the now infamous July 25th phone call, the president recommended to Zelensky in the context of the two investigations the president wanted into the 2016 election and the Bidens?
Yes.
And finally, Ambassador, in that July 25th phone call, the president praises one of these corrupt former Ukrainian prosecutors and says they were treated very unfairly. They were treated unfairly. Not you, who was smeared and recalled, but one of them. What message does that send to your colleagues in the U.S. Embassy in Kiev?
I'm just not sure what the basis for that kind of a statement would be. Certainly not from our reporting over years.
Did you have concern, though, or do you have concern today about what message the president's action sends to the people who are still in Ukraine representing the United States when a well-respected ambassador can be smeared out of her post with the participation and acquiescence of the president of the United States?
Well, it's, I think, been a big hit for morale, both at U.S. Embassy Kyiv, but also more broadly in the State Department.
Is it fair to say that other ambassadors and others of lesser rank who serve the United States and embassies around the world might look at this and think, if I take on corrupt people in these countries, that could happen to me?
I think that's a fair statement, yes.
Mr. Goldman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ambassador Yovanovitch, on April 24th of this year, at approximately 10 p.m., you received a telephone call while you were at the embassy in Kyiv from the Director General of the State Department. This was just 3 days after President Zelensky's election and the call between President Trump and President Zelensky that we just heard from Ranking Member Nunes. At the time that this urgent call came in, what were you in the middle of doing?
I was hosting an event in honor of Katya Hanzyuk, who is an anti-corruption activist, or was an anti-corruption activist in Ukraine. We had given her the Woman of Courage Award from Ukraine, and in fact, the Worldwide Woman of Courage event at the Worldwide Woman of Courage event in Washington, D.C., Secretary Pompeo singled her out for her amazing work in Ukraine to fight corrupt interests in the south of Ukraine. She very tragically died because she was attacked by acid. And several months later died a very, very painful death. We thought it was important that justice be done for Katya Hanzyuk and for others who fight corruption in Ukraine, because this is, it's not a, you know, kind of a tabletop exercise there. Lives are in the balance. And so we wanted to bring attention to this. We held an event and gave her father, who, of course, is still mourning her, that award, the Women of Courage event.
And her Women of Courage award stemmed from her anti-corruption efforts in Ukraine?
Yes, that is true.
Was it ever determined who threw the acid and killed her?
There have been investigations, but while some of the lower-ranking individuals that were involved in this have been arrested, those who ordered this have not yet been apprehended.
After you stepped away from this anti-corruption event to take this call, what did the Director General tell you?
She said that there was great concern on the seventh floor of the State Department. That's where the leadership of the State Department sits. There was great concern. They were worried. She just wanted to give me a heads up about this. And, you know, things seemed to be going on. And so she just wanted to give me a heads up. I, you know, hard to know how to react to something like that. I asked her what it was about. What did she think it was about? She didn't know. She said that she was going to try and find out more, but she had wanted to give me a heads up. In fact, I think she may even have been instructed to give me a heads up on that. And so I asked her, you know, kind of what is the next step here? So she said she would try to find out more, and she would try to call me by midnight.
What happened next?
Around 1 o'clock in the morning, she called me again, and she said that there were great concerns. There were concerns up the street, and she said I needed to get on come home immediately, get on the next plane to the U.S. And I asked her why. And she said she wasn't sure, but there were concerns about my security. I asked her my physical security, because sometimes Washington knows more than we do about these things. And she said no, she hadn't gotten that impression that it was a physical security issue, but they were concerned about my security, and I needed to come home right away. You know, I argued this is extremely irregular, and no reason given. But in the end, I did get on the next plane home.
You said there were concerns up the street. What did you understand that to mean?
The White House.
Did she explain in any more detail what she meant by concerns about your security?
No, she didn't. I did specifically ask whether this had to do with the Mayor Giuliani's allegations against me and so forth. And she said she didn't know. It didn't even actually appear to me that she seemed to be aware of that. No reason was offered.
Did she explain what the urgency was for you to come back on the next flight?
The only thing that's pertinent to that was that when she said that there were concerns about my security, that's all. But it was not further explained.
Now, prior to this abrupt call back to Washington, D.C., had you been offered an extension of your post by the State Department?
Yes. The Undersecretary for Political Affairs had asked whether I would extend for another year, departing in July of 2020.
When was that request made?
In early March.
So about a month and a half before this call?
Yes.
Did anyone at the State Department ever express concerns about your job performance?
No.
Now, after you returned to Washington a couple days after that, you met with the Deputy Secretary of State. And at your deposition, you said that the Deputy Secretary of State told you that you had done nothing wrong, but that there was a concerted campaign against you. What did he mean by that?
I'm not exactly sure, but I took it to mean that the allegations that Mayor Giuliani and others were putting out there, that's what it was.
And who else was involved in this concerted campaign against you?
There were some members of the press and others in Mayor Giuliani's circle.
And who from Ukraine?
In Ukraine, I think, Mr. Lutsenko, the prosecutor general, and Mr. Shokin, his predecessor, certainly.
And at this time, Mr. Lutsenko was the lead prosecutor general, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And had President Zelensky indicated whether or not he was going to keep him on after the election?
He had indicated he would not be keeping on Mr. Lutsenko.
And I believe you testified earlier that Mr. Lutsenko had a reputation for being corrupt, is that right?
That's correct.
Now, during this conversation, did the deputy secretary tell you about your future as the ambassador to Ukraine?
Well, he told me I needed to leave.
What did he say?
He said that, there was a lot of back and forth, but ultimately he said the words that, you know, every Foreign Service officer understands, the president has lost confidence in you. That was, you know, a terrible thing to hear. And I said, well, you know, I guess I have to go then. But no real reason was offered as to why I had to leave and why it was being done in such a manner.
Did you have any indication that the State Department had lost confidence in you?
No.
And were you provided any reason why the president lost confidence in you?
No.
Now, you testified at your deposition that you were told at some point that Secretary Pompeo had tried to protect you, but that he was no longer able to do that. Were you aware of these efforts to protect you?
No, I was not until that meeting with Deputy Secretary Sullivan.
And did you understand who he was trying to protect you from?
Well, my understanding was that the president had wanted me to leave, and there was some discussion about that over the prior months.
Did you have any understanding why Secretary Pompeo was no longer able to protect you?
No, it was just a statement made that he was no longer able to protect me.
So just like that, you had to leave Ukraine as soon as possible?
Yes.
How did that make you feel?
Terrible, honestly. After 33 years of service to our country, it was terrible. It's not the way I wanted my career to end.
Now, you also told this deputy secretary that this was a dangerous precedent. What did you mean by that?
I was worried about our policy, but also personnel. And I asked him, how are you going to explain this to people in the State Department, the press, the public, Ukrainians, because everybody is watching. And so if people see somebody who, and of course it had been very public, the attacks on me by Mayor Giuliani and others, and Mr. Lutsenko in Ukraine, if people see that I, who have been, promoting our policies on anti-corruption, if they can undermine me and get me pulled out of Ukraine, what does that mean for our policy? Do we still have that same policy? How are we going to affirmatively put that forward, number one? Number two, when other countries, other actors in other countries see that private interests, foreign interests can come together and get a U.S. ambassador removed, what's going to stop them from doing that in the future in other countries? Often, the work we do, we try to be diplomatic about it, but as Deputy Assistant Secretary George Kent said, sometimes we get people really angry with us. It's uncomfortable. And we are doing our jobs. But sometimes people become very angry with us. And if they realize that they can just remove us, they're going to do that.
How did the deputy secretary respond?
He said those were good questions, and he would get back to me.
Did he ever get back to you?
He asked to see me the following day.
What did he say to you then?
The conversation was more, again, I'm grateful for this, but really more to see how I was doing what would I do next, how could he help?
But he didn't address the dangerous precedent that you flagged for him?
No.
Now, you understood, of course, that the President of the United States could remove you and that you served at the pleasure of the President. Is that right?
That's right.
But in your 33 years as a Foreign Service officer, have you ever heard of a President of the United States recalling another ambassador without cause based on allegations that the State Department itself knew to be false?
No.
Now, you testified in your opening statement that you had left Ukraine by the time of the July 25th call between President Trump and President Zelensky. When was the first time that you saw the call record for this phone call?
When it was released publicly at the end of September, I believe.
And prior to reading that call record, were you aware that President Trump had specifically made reference to you in that call?
No.
What was your reaction to learning that?
I was shocked. Absolutely shocked and devastated, frankly.
What do you mean by devastated?
I was shocked and devastated that I would feature in a phone call between two heads of state in such a manner where President Trump said that I was bad news to another world leader and that I would be going through some things. So I was... It was a terrible moment. A person who saw me actually reading the transcript said that the color drained from my face. I think I even had a physical reaction. I think, you know, even now, words kind of fail me.
Well, without upsetting you too much, I'd like to show you the excerpts from the call. And the first one, where President Trump says the former ambassador from the United States, the woman, was bad news, and the people she was dealing with in the Ukraine were bad news. So I just want to let you know. What was your reaction when you heard the President of the United States refer to you as bad news?
I couldn't believe it. I mean, again, shocked, appalled, devastated that the President of the United States would talk about any ambassador like that to a foreign head of state. And it was me. I mean, I couldn't believe it.
The next excerpt, when the President references you, was a short one. But he said, well, she's going to go through some things. What did you think when President Trump told President Zelensky and you read that you were going to go through some things?
I didn't know what to think, but I was very concerned.
What were you concerned about?
She's going to go through some things. It didn't sound good. It sounded like a threat.
Did you feel threatened?
I did.
How so?
I didn't know exactly. It's not, you know, a very precise phrase, but I think it didn't feel like I was... I really don't know how to answer the question any further except to say that it kind of felt like a vague threat, and so I wondered what that meant. It concerned me.
Now, in the same call where the President, as you just said, threatens you to a foreign leader, he also praises the corrupt Ukrainian prosecutor who led the false smear campaign against you. I want to show you another excerpt or two from the transcript, or the call record, rather, where the President of the United States says, good, because I heard you had a prosecutor who was very good and he was shut down, and that's really unfair. A lot of people are talking about that, the way they shut your very good prosecutor down, and you had some very bad people involved. And he went on later to say, I heard the prosecutor was treated very badly, and he was a very fair prosecutor. So good luck with everything. Now, Ambassador Yovanovitch, after nearly 3 years in Ukraine where you tried to clean up the prosecutor general's office, was it the U.S. Embassy's view that the former prosecutor general was a very good and very fair prosecutor?
No, it was not.
And in fact, he was rather corrupt. Is that right?
That was our belief.
The prosecutor general's office is a long-running problem in Ukraine. Is that right?
Yes.
So how did you feel when you heard President Trump speak so highly of the corrupt Ukrainian prosecutor who helped to execute the smear campaign to have you removed?
Well, it was disappointing. It was concerning. It wasn't certainly based on anything that the State Department would have reported or, frankly, anybody else in the U.S. government. There was an interagency consensus that while when Mr. Lutsenko came into office, we were very hopeful that he would actually do the things that he said he would set out to do, including reforming the prosecutor general's office. But that did not materialize.
So this was not the uniform position of the official U.S. policymakers. Is that right?
Right.
Now, let's go back to the smear campaign that you referenced, and in March when you said it became public. And you previously testified that you had learned that Rudy Giuliani, President Trump's lawyer and representative, who was also mentioned in that July 25th call, was in regular communication with the corrupt prosecutor general in late 2018 and in early 2019. And at one point in your deposition, you said that they, that being Giuliani and the corrupt foreign prosecutor general, had plans to, quote, do things to me. What did you mean by that?
I didn't really know, but that's what I had been told by Ukrainian officials.
Did you subsequently understand a little bit more what that meant?
Well, you know, now, with the advantage of hindsight, I think that meant removing me from my job in Ukraine.
Who did you understand to be working with Mr. Giuliani as his associates in Ukraine?
Well, certainly Mr. Lutsenko, Mr. Shokhin. I believe that there were also Ukrainian Americans, Mr. Parnas and Mr. Fruman, who have recently been indicted.
Those are the two who have been indicted in New York?
Southern District of New York.
Now, at the end of March, this effort by Giuliani and his associates resulted in a series of articles in the Hill publication that were based on allegations in part from Lutsenko, the corrupt prosecutor general. And just to summarize some of these allegations, there were, among others, three different categories. One category included the attacks against you, which you referenced in your opening statement, including that you had badmouthed the president and had given the prosecutor general a do not prosecute list. There was another that included allegations of Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election. And then there was a third that related to allegations concerning Burisma and the Bidens. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Yes.
Were these articles and allegations then promoted by others associated with the president in the United States?
They seem to be promoted by those around Mayor Giuliani.
I'm going to show you a couple of exhibits, including a tweet here by President Trump himself on March 20th, which was the first day that one of these articles was published. It appears to be a quote that says, John Solomon, who's the author of the articles, colon, as Russia collusion fades, Ukrainian plot to help Clinton emerges, unquote, at Sean Hannity at Fox News. And then if I could go to another tweet 4 days later, this is the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., who tweets, we need more at Richard Grenell's, who's the ambassador to Germany, is that right?
That's correct.
And less of these jokers as ambassadors. And it's a retweet of one of John Solomon's articles or an article referencing the allegations that says calls grow to remove Obama's U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. Were you aware of these tweets at the time?
Yes.
What was your reaction to seeing this?
Well, I was worried.
What were you worried about?
That this didn't seem, these attacks were, being repeated by the president himself and his son.
And were you aware whether they received attention on primetime television, on Fox News as well?
Yes, they did.
Now, was the allegation that you were bad-mouthing President Trump true?
No.
Was the allegation that you had created a do-not-prosecute list to give to the prosecutor general in Ukraine true?
No.
In fact, didn't the corrupt prosecutor general himself later recant those allegations?
Yes.
Now, when these articles were first published, did the State Department issue a response?
As you said, there was a series of articles. So after the first article, which was an interview with Mr. Lutsenko and was only really about me and made certain allegations about me, the State Department came out the following day with a very strong statement saying that, these allegations were fabrications.
So the statement addressed the falsity of the allegations themselves?
Yes.
It didn't say anything about your job performance in any way?
Honestly, I haven't looked at it in a very long time. I think it was generally probably laudatory, but I can't recall.
Did anyone in the State Department raise any concerns with you or express any belief in these allegations?
No. I mean, people thought it was ridiculous.
Now, after these false allegations were made against you, did you have any discussions with anyone in leadership in the State Department about a potential statement of support from the department or the secretary himself?
Yes. After the tweets that you just showed us, it seemed to me that if the president's son is saying things like this, that it would be very hard to continue in my position and have authority in Ukraine unless the State Department came out pretty strongly behind me. And so, over over the weekend of March 22nd, I think that's about the date, there was a lot of discussion on email among a number of people about what could be done. The Undersecretary for Political Affairs called me on Sunday, and I said, it's really important that the Secretary himself come out and be supportive, because otherwise it's hard for me to be the kind of representative you need here. And he said he would talk to the Secretary. I mean, that's my recollection of the call. That may not be exactly how it played out, but that was my recollection.
This is David Hale, the Undersecretary of Political Affairs, who's the number three person at the State Department.
Yes.
Did he indicate to you that he supported such a statement of support for you?
I think he must have, because I don't think he would have gone to the Secretary if he didn't support it. I mean, you wouldn't bring a bad idea to the Secretary of State.
And your general understanding is that you did have the full support of the State Department, is that right?
Yes.
And in fact, during your 33-year career as a Foreign Service officer, did you ever hear of any serious concerns about your job performance?
No.
Was this statement of support ultimately issued for you?
No, it was not.
Did you learn why not?
Yeah, yes. I was told that there was a concern on the seventh floor that if a statement of support was issued, whether by the State Department or by the Secretary personally, that it could be undermined.
How could it be undermined?
That the president might issue a tweet contradicting that or something to that effect.
So let me see if I get this right. You were one of the most senior diplomats in the State Department. You've been there for 33 years. You'd won numerous awards. You've been appointed as an ambassador three times by both Republican and Democratic presidents. And the State Department would not issue a statement in support of you against false allegations because they were concerned about a tweet from the President of the United States?
That's my understanding.
Mr. Goldman, if I could follow up on that question, it seems like an appropriate time. Vasily Ivanovich, as we sit here testifying, the president is attacking you on Twitter. And I'd like to give you a chance to respond. I'll read part of one of his tweets. Everywhere Marie Ivanovich went turned bad. She started off in Somalia. How did that go? He goes on to say, later in the tweet, is a U.S. president's absolute right to appoint ambassadors. First of all, Ambassador Ivanovich, the Senate has a chance to confirm or deny an ambassador, do they not?
Yes, advise and consent.
But would you like to respond to the president's attack that everywhere you went turned bad?
Well, I don't think I have such powers, not in Mogadishu, Somalia, and not in other places. I actually think that where I've served over the years, I and others have demonstrably made things better, you know, for the U.S. as well as for the countries that I've served in. Ukraine, for example, where there are huge challenges, including, you know, on the issue that we're discussing today of corruption. Huge challenges, but they've made a lot of progress since 2014, including in the years that I was there. And I think, in part, the Ukrainian people get the most credit for that. But a part of that credit goes to the work of the United States and to me as the ambassador in Ukraine.
Ambassador, you've shown the courage to come forward today and testify. Notwithstanding the fact you were urged by the White House or State Department not to, notwithstanding the fact that, as you testified earlier, the president implicitly threatened you in that call record, and now the president in real time is attacking you, what effect do you think that has on other witnesses' willingness to come forward and expose wrongdoing?
Well, it's very intimidating.
It's designed to intimidate, is it not?
I mean, I can't speak to what the president is trying to do, but I think the effect is to be intimidating.
Well, I want to let you know, Ambassador, that some of us here take witness intimidation very, very seriously. Mr. Goldman.
Ambassador Ivanovich, you indicated that those same articles in March that included the smear campaign also included allegations related to Ukraine's interference in the 2016 election and the Burisma-Biden connection. Is that right?
Yes.
So I'm going to end my questioning where we were before, which was the July 25th call. And President Trump not only insults you and praises the corrupt prosecutor general, but he also, as you know by now, references these two investigations. First, immediately after President Zelensky thanks President Trump for his, quote, great support in the area of defense, unquote, President Trump responds, I would like you to do us a favor, though, because our country has been through a lot and Ukraine knows a lot about it. I would like you to find out what happened with this whole situation with Ukraine. They say CrowdStrike. I guess you have one of your wealthy people, the server. They say Ukraine has it. And then he goes on in that same paragraph to say, whatever you can do, it's very important that you do it if that's possible. Now, Ambassador Ivanovich, from your experience as the ambassador in Ukraine for almost 3 years, and understanding that President Zelensky was not in politics before he ran for president and was a new president on this call, how would you expect President Zelensky to interpret a request for a favor?
The U.S. Relationship for Ukraine is the single most important relationship. And so I think that President Zelensky, any president, would, do what they could to, lean in on a favor request. I'm not saying that that's a yes. I'm saying they would try to lean in and see what they could do.
Fair to say that a president of Ukraine that is so dependent on the United States would do just about anything within his power to please the president of the United States, if he could?
You know, if he could. I mean, I'm sure there are limits, and I understand there were a lot of discussions in the Ukrainian government about all of this. But we are an important relationship on the security side and on the political side. And so the president of Ukraine, one of the most important functions that individual has is to make sure the relationship with the U.S. is rock solid.
Now, are you familiar with these allegations of Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election?
I mean, there have been rumors out there about things like that. But, there was nothing hard, at least nothing that I was aware of.
There's nothing based in fact to support these allegations.
Yes.
And, in fact, who was responsible for interfering and meddling in the 2016 election?
Well, the U.S. intelligence community has concluded that it was Russia.
Ambassador Yovanovitch, are you aware that in February of 2017, Vladimir Putin himself promoted this theory of Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election?
You know, maybe I knew that once and have forgotten, but I'm not familiar with it now.
Well, let me show you a press statement that President Putin made in a joint press conference with Viktor Orban of Hungary on February 2nd of 2017. Where he says, second, as we all know, during the presidential campaign in the United States, the Ukrainian government adopted a unilateral position in favor of one candidate. More than that, certain oligarchs, certainly with the approval of the political leadership, funded this candidate, or female candidate, to be more precise. Now, how would this theory of Ukraine interference in the 2016 election be in Vladimir Putin's interest?
Well, President Putin must have been aware that there were concerns in the U.S. about Russian meddling in the 2016 elections and what the potential was for Russian meddling in the future. Classic for an intelligence officer to try to throw off the scent and, create an alternative narrative that maybe might get picked up and get some credence.
An alternative narrative that would absolve his own wrongdoing?
Yeah.
And when he talks about an oligarch and he talks about the support of the Ukrainian government, there's also a reference in the July 25th call to a wealthy Ukrainian. Is it your understanding that what Vladimir Putin is saying here in this press statement in February 2017 is similar to what President Trump says on the July 25th call related to the 2016 election?
Maybe.
Now, let me show you another exhibit from the call related to the Bidens, which I'm sure you're familiar with. President Trump says the other thing. There's a lot of talk about Biden's son, that Biden stopped the prosecution, and a lot of people want to find out about that. So whatever you can do with the attorney general would be great. Biden went around bragging that he stopped the prosecution. So if you can look into it, it sounds horrible to me. Now, are you familiar with these allegations related to Vice President Biden?
Yes.
Do you know whether he ever went around bragging that he stopped the prosecution of anyone?
No.
And in fact, when Vice President Biden acted to remove the former corrupt prosecutor in Ukraine, did he do so as part of official United States policy?
Official U.S. policy. that and that was endorsed and was the policy of a number of other international stakeholders, other countries, other monetary institutions, financial institutions.
And in fact, if he helped to remove a corrupt Ukrainian prosecutor general who was not prosecuting enough corruption, that would increase the chances that corrupt companies in Ukraine would be investigated. Isn't that right?
One would think so.
And that could include Burisma, right?
Yes.
Now, at the time of this call, Vice President Biden was the front runner for the Democratic nomination for president and President Trump's potential next opponent in the election. Is it your understanding that President Trump's request to have Vice President Biden investigated, was that part of official U.S. policy as you knew it?
Well, I should say that I had, at the time of this phone call, I had already departed Ukraine 2 months prior.
Right, but you're familiar with it. It didn't change that much in 2 months, right?
It certainly would not have been the policy in May when I left.
And were these two investigations part of the anti-corruption platform that you championed in Ukraine for 3 years?
No.
And these investigations, do they appear to you to be to benefit the president's personal and political interests rather than the national interest?
Well, they certainly could.
Now, just returning to the allegations in the Hill publication in March that were promoted by Mr. Giuliani, the president's lawyer, were those two allegations similar to the two allegations that the president wanted President Zelensky to investigate?
Yes.
So ultimately, in the July 25th phone call with the Ukrainian president, the president of the United States endorsed the false allegations against you and the Bidens. Is that right?
Yes.
I yield back, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Nunes, you're recognized for 45 minutes along with Minority Counsel.
I assume that you know who Senator Grassley is.
Yes, sir, I do.
Do you believe that Senator Grassley is a serious and credible elected official?
I have no reason to think otherwise.
Were you involved in the July 25th Trump-Zelensky phone call or preparations for the call?
No, I was not.
Were you involved in the deliberations about the pause in military sales to Ukraine as the Trump administration reviewed newly elected President Zelensky's commitment to corruption reforms?
For the delay in?
For the pause.
The pause? No, I was not.
Were you involved in the proposed Trump-Zelensky, later Pence-Zelensky, meetings in Warsaw, Poland on September 1st?
No, I was not.
Did you ever talk to President Trump in 2019?
No, I have not.
Mick Mulvaney?
No, I have not.
All right. Mr. Kasser, you're recognized.
You were serving a three-year assignment in the Ukraine, is that correct?
Yes.
And it began in 2016 and was scheduled to end in 2019?
Yes, that's correct.
And nobody disputes that it's up to the president to decide who his envoys are to post around the world, correct?
I stated that clearly in my statement.
And you returned from the Ukraine on May 20th, 2019?
That's correct.
And your return coincided with the inauguration of President Zelensky?
Yes.
And you remain employed by the State Department?
I do.
And after you returned to Washington, the Deputy Secretary, John Sullivan, asked you what you wanted to do next. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And then you met with the Director General, Ambassador Perez?
Yes, that's correct.
To identify a meaningful new assignment?
Yes.
And you now serve at Georgetown University as a fellow?
That's true.
And this is a rewarding position for you?
I'm very grateful to be in that position after what happened.
Today is the second big hearing for the Democrats' impeachment initiative. But we don't understand, or we do understand, that you don't have a lot of facts and information relating to the part of this that we're investigating. And those are the events from May 20th up until September 11th, the release of the security assistance funds. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's correct.
So you were not part of the delegation to the inauguration. That was the day you returned. You were not part of the Oval Office meeting May 23rd, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And you were not part of the decision-making relating to whether there would be a White House meeting with President Zelensky?
That's correct.
And you were not a part of any decision-making in the lead-up to the July 25th call?
That's correct.
And you first learned about the call on September 25th. Is that correct?
Well, I heard about the call, as I indicated in the first deposition, from Deputy Assistant Secretary George Kent.
And what did he tell you about the call?
Well, as it turns out, it wasn't correct. But what I recall is that he said that President Trump had asked President Zelensky whether he could, you know, help him out, and which I understood to be these investigations, and that President Zelensky had said that he is putting in a new prosecutor general and that he doesn't control. I mean, this is approximately what he said, that person is an independent individual.
Okay. And you learned about that before the call was made public?
That's correct.
Likewise, you were not involved in any discussions surrounding the security sector assistance funds to Ukraine. They were paused for about 55 days from July 18th to September 11th?
No discussions.
Okay. In your your opening statement on page 9, you stated, although then and now I've always understood that I served at the pleasure of the president, I still find it difficult to comprehend that foreign and private interests were able to undermine U.S. interests in this way. Individuals who apparently felt stymied by our efforts to promote stated U.S. policy against corruption, that is, to do the mission, were able to successfully conduct a campaign of disinformation against the sitting ambassador using unofficial back channels. Do you believe that President Trump was aiming to weaponize corruption in Ukraine by removing you?
I don't know that.
Okay. Do you believe your removal was part of some scheme to make it easier for elements of the Ukrainian establishment to do things counter to U.S. interests?
I think that's certainly what the Ukrainian establishment hoped. I think that, in addition, there were Americans, these two individuals, who were working with Mayor Giuliani, Mr. Parnas, and Mr. Fruman, who have recently been indicted by the Southern District of New York, who indicated that they wanted to change out the ambassador. And I think they must have had some reason for that.
And do you think they were seeking a different type of ambassador that would allow them to achieve some of their objectives?
I don't know what other reason there would be.
Okay. Is Ambassador Taylor the type of person that would facilitate those objectives?
No.
So Ambassador Taylor is a man of high integrity?
Absolutely.
And he's a good pick for the post?
He is. I would note that he is the chargé out there, as of course you understand. So no ambassador has yet been, or no candidate has yet been named to the position.
But he certainly has had a decorated career serving his country.
Absolutely, a man of the highest integrity.
You testified about when you first learned that Mayor Giuliani and some of his associates were had a concerted campaign against you. When did that first come to your attention?
We were picking up rumors from Ukrainians. I think, you know, kind of in the November, December 2018 time period. But then in January, February, and of course, March, it became more obvious.
At some point, I believe you testified that Minister Avakov alerted you to this campaign?
Yes.
And when was that?
He had a conversation with me in February of 2019.
Okay. And do you remember what he related to you?
Yes. He said that Mr. Lutsenko was working with Mayor Giuliani through these two individuals, Mr. Parnas and Mr. Fruman, that they basically wanted to remove me from post, and that they were working on that.
And did you have any awareness at that point in time of precisely why they were seeking your ouster?
You know, I didn't understand that at all, because I had never met Mr. Parnas and Mr. Fruman. And so it was unclear to me why they were interested in doing this.
Were you especially influential implementing policies that stymied their interests in Ukraine? Were advocating for the some sort of environment or policies that would be adverse to them?
I think that just the general idea that obviously U.S. ambassadors, U.S. embassies, one of our most important functions is to facilitate U.S. business abroad, right? Whether it's trade, whether it's commerce. That's one of the things that we do. And but, you know, everything has to be above board. We believe in a level playing ground and so forth, but we obviously advocate for U.S. business. These two individuals, you know, with hindsight and what we learned later, looking to open up a new energy company exporting liquefied natural gas to Ukraine, never actually came to the embassy, which is unusual because that would usually be a first stop, going to the American Chamber of Commerce, going to the U.S. Embassy, get the lay of the land, see how we could provide assistance.
And was that source of frustration ever expressed to you, or did you just learn that separately?
Source of frustration? What
right.
do you mean? On whose part?
On Fruman and Parnas.
I don't know that they were frustrated. I mean, I
okay.
Frustrated by what?
Well, you mentioned that they had business interests, and you know, I asked you whether they had been stymied by anything in particular that you had advocated for, or you were a roadblock to them being successful. Yeah. I wondered if there was any connection.
I'd never met them. When I heard those names for the first time, which was in February of 2019, I asked my team, the econ and the commercial sections are the ones who would usually meet with American businessmen and women, and nobody had heard of them. So all I can conclude is that it was the general U.S. policies that we were implementing that might have been of concern to them.
Okay. And at any point, did you ever try to reach out to the Prosecutor General, Mr. Lutsenko, and find out why he was participating in this concerted campaign?
No.
And then why didn't you do that?
I didn't feel that there was any purpose to it.
Why not?
He is... he clearly had... I would say an animus for doing this, and he was working with Americans. So I reached out to the American side, in this case the State Department, to try and find out what was going on.
When did you first realize that your relationship with Lutsenko had reached an adversarial point?
Probably around that time, maybe a little bit earlier.
And this is March?
Yeah. And what I would say, adversarial, that's a really strong word. We at the U.S. Embassy are visiting key people from the State Department and other agencies. We were pushing the Ukrainians, including Mr. Lutsenko, to do what they said that they were going to do when Mr. Lutsenko entered office, mm-hmm. That he was going to clean up the PGO and make reforms, that he was going to bring justice to the what they call the Heavenly Hundred, the people who died on the Maidan in 2014, the Revolution of Dignity. And he was going to prosecute cases to repatriate the approximately $40 billion. It's believed that former President Yanukovych and his cronies fled the country with. And he didn't do any of that. And we, you know, kept on trying to encourage him to do the right thing. That's what the Ukrainian people wanted to do, him to do, and we thought it was a good plan and that he should do it.
Okay. And then you mentioned you contacted the State Department in late March. Was that Undersecretary Hale?
So contacted about what?
About the concerns you had about the campaign against you?
I contacted the State Department much earlier than that. I mean, it was an ongoing sort of discussion makes it sound very formal. We have many ways of going back and forth with Washington. On phone calls or DVCs, we would have this discussion.
When did you realize this?
And if I could just amplify my answer, we had the discussion because we were concerned that Ukrainian policymakers, Ukrainian leaders were hearing that I was going to be leaving, that, there was maybe somebody else waiting in the wings, et cetera. And that undermined not only my position, but our U.S. position. The Ukrainians didn't know what to think. And we need to be out there all the time, firing on all cylinders to promote our national security interests. So it was a concern.
And when did you realize this concerted campaign against you was a real threat?
A threat?
A threat to your ability to do the job in Kyiv?
I would say that when you go into a meeting with somebody and they ask, are you going to be leaving, that is concerning. so that probably, I don't know exactly when that started happening, but in that time frame.
And did you undertake any efforts to push back on this narrative, either inside the State Department or publicly?
Certainly with the Ukrainians, I said, there's nothing to this. This is, a distraction, and we are focused on the job. Our policy remains the same. Yes, we had discussions in the State Department about this.
In hindsight, do you think you did enough inside the State Department to alert them to this this mounting campaign against you?
I did what I could.
And what was that?
Reached out to the European Bureau. I think you've also heard that Dr. Fiona Hill was aware of this as well, so the NSC, and they had other discussions with more senior people.
Okay. Did you get any feedback from your chain of command? I mean, did you engage Ambassador Rieker,
yes.
Undersecretary Hale?
Yes.
And
yes.
Did you develop sort of a game plan to push back against these allegations?
So, I mean, there are different time frames here that we're talking about. So, fast forwarding to March, I did, when Undersecretary Hale asked whether I would consider extending, I did raise, because I wasn't sure that he was aware of it. I wanted to make sure that he knew that Mayor Giuliani had been out there saying things about me, untrue things, and I wanted him to be aware of that. And he said, he understood. He still was hoping that I could extend for another year. So that was early March, and then fast forward to late March. And, the discussions about this issue continued, but obviously once it became a public political story here in the United States, the tenor of everything changed, because I think that the State Department felt that it wasn't manageable anymore, and that the more prudent thing would be for me to come back in July.
Do you think there was anything you could have done differently to get ahead of the story and to lobby the secretary and his counselor, Mr. Breckbuehl, that there was a concerted campaign against you, that you didn't believe the allegations lodged were accurate and you needed their assistance?
Sure, maybe I could have done that, but I think they were aware. And as I subsequently learned from Deputy Secretary Sullivan, the Secretary of State had been well aware of this since the summer of 2018.
The corruption's endemic in the country of Ukraine, right?
I would say that corruption is a serious issue everywhere in the former Soviet Union. It's a post-Soviet legacy. And we talk about it a lot in Ukraine because there's actually an opportunity to do something, to actually help the Ukrainians tackle the issue. They want to tackle the issue. In other countries, like Russia, you can't even talk about it. So I think it's a post-Soviet legacy, and it's important to deal with it.
And that you testified rampant corruption has long permeated Ukraine's political and economic systems?
Yes, that's a fair statement.
And it's your belief that it should be the U.S. foreign policy to help Ukraine curb its corruption problem?
Yes, because it's good for the Ukrainians, but it's also in our interests.
And anti-corruption efforts, you mentioned, serve a national security purpose?
I believe that to be true.
Are oligarchs a big part of the problem in Ukraine?
Probably, because so much wealth is concentrated in the hands of a very, very few, six or seven individuals, and they also have political power and control the media.
And a lot of their power has been acquired through what we here in the U.S. would consider improper ways.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment.
The head of Burisma, Mr. Sochevsky, you familiar with him?
I don't know him, but I know who you're talking about.
George Kent testified a couple days ago that he was investigating for, stealing millions and millions of dollars, some of which had been supplied by the U.S., Great Britain. Subject to an investigation, trying to get the money back. That was a big part of Mr. Kent's initiatives when he was there. That a bribe was paid to the prosecutors, and Sochevsky was let off the hook. This was in 2014. Is this something that you're familiar with?
I've heard about it. This was before my arrival. And I would just say my understanding, please correct me if I'm wrong, is that the U.S. money that you're referring to was the money that we used to fund an FBI team that was embedded with the Prosecutor General's office to go after to do the investigation of Burisma and Sochevsky.
Mr. Kent testified that this bribe was paid, the prosecution went away, and essentially nothing has been further done with regards to Burisma. During your tenure in Ukraine, has there ever been any focus on reexamining allegations, whether it's at Burisma or other powerful interests like Sochevsky, reexamining it?
Is that on the part of the Ukrainian government? Is that what you're talking about?
Trying to lean on the various prosecutors general to clean up the oligarchical system.
I think, yes, there have been some efforts. And as I mentioned earlier in my testimony, the U.S. was welcoming of Mr. Lutsenko's nomination to the position of prosecutor general because we were hoping he would clean that up. That, in fact, is not what happened. And because, it's kind of hard to explain to a U.S. audience, but in Ukraine, in the former Soviet Union more broadly, including in Russia, justice, the justice system, whether it's the cops on the beat, whether it's investigators, whether it is prosecutors, whether it is judges, are used as a tool of the political system to be used against your political adversaries. And so I think that, going back to your question about Burisma and Zlochevsky, my understanding, this was, as I told you earlier in the previous deposition, this did not loom large when I arrived. I arrived August 2016. But over time, my understanding was that the case was basically sort of on a pause, that it wasn't an active case, but it also was not fully closed. And that is a way, as I mentioned before, for those in power to keep a little hook in to Burisma and Mr. Zlochevsky.
And right around the time the bribe was paid, Burisma undertook an effort to spruce up their board, and they added, I believe, the president of Poland and some other luminaries. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I don't exactly know what the timing of all this was.
Okay.
But yes, I mean, to the elements.
And, you know, one of the folks they added to the board was the vice president's son, Hunter Biden, which, you know, raises questions. Is he a genius on the corporate governance front? Is he a genius with the Ukrainian oligarchical systems and cleaning that up? Or was he just added to the board because he's the vice president's son? Was that ever, you know, a concern, or at least the perception of that concern addressed?
As I said, I arrived in August of 2016, you know, several months before the elections and several months before President Trump took office. And it was not a focus of what I was doing in that six-month period.
Okay. Was the issue ever raised at all?
You know, not...
He was still on the board, I think, at the time.
Yeah, my understanding from newspaper accounts is that he just recently left in 2019.
Right.
I never met him, never talked to him. And I'm sorry, what was your question?
He was still on the board when you arrived at Post, and was just wondering if at least the perception problem was brought to your attention as the ambassador.
I was aware of it because, as I told you before, and in the deposition, there had been a, in terms of the preparation for my Senate confirmation hearings for Ukraine, there was a question about that and a select answer. So I was aware of it.
Okay.
Yes.
In your deposition, you acknowledged that the president has longstanding concerns about corruption in Ukraine. Is that true?
That's what he says.
Well, going back to there was a meeting with President Poroshenko in September of 2017 in the Oval Office, and I believe you testified that, you know, he expressed his concerns then.
Yeah, he said that a friend of his had told him that Ukraine was the most corrupt country in the world.
Okay. Several witnesses have testified that the president has concerns that there are certain elements of the Ukrainian establishment that during 2016 were out to get him. Is that something you were aware of at any point in time?
Well, I'm certainly aware of it now. Obviously, there's been a lot of press attention on that. It was not brought to my attention during the 2.5 years that I served under President Trump as our ambassador to Ukraine.
We've gone through the deposition some of these elements that, you know, maybe they loom larger now, but, you know, in hindsight, was there any discussion at the embassy that there's these indications of some Ukrainians trying to, you know, at least advocate against then-candidate Trump?
Actually, there weren't. I mean, we didn't really see it that way.
And were you aware of, I know Mr. Nunes mentioned this earlier, the consultant Alexander Chalupa had reportedly, at least according to her and according to, you know, Ken Vogel at the Politico, was trying to work with the Ukrainian embassy in D.C. to, you know, trade information, share leads of that sort of thing?
I saw the article. I, you know, didn't have any further information about that.
And did you see the article at the time, or did that only come to your attention subsequently?
It's certainly been brought to my attention subsequently. I think I did see something to that effect at the time as well.
And you know, you're the ambassador in country at this point. Did you aim to get to the bottom of that? Because, you know, if the reporting's true, if what Ms. Chalupa told Mr. Vogel is accurate, that would be concerning, correct?
Well, I was the ambassador in Ukraine starting in August of 2016. And what you're describing, if true, as you said, what you're describing took place in the United States. So if there were concerns about what Ms. Chalupa was doing, I think that would have been handled here.
And do you know Ms. Chalupa?
I don't believe so.
Do you ever met her?
I don't think so. I mean, if she worked for the Ukrainian embassy, it's possible that I met her in a large group or something, but I don't believe I know her.
Okay. Are you aware of the role that investigative journalist Mr. Leshenko played in publicizing the Manafort black ledgers?
Yes.
And he publicized some information in a pretty grand way in August of 2016, and almost immediately coincided with Mr. Manafort leaving the Trump campaign. Was there anything about that issue when it was occurring that concerned you?
Well, I certainly noticed it because I was, you know, a week or so away from arriving in Ukraine. I think that from a Ukrainian perspective, I realize we are looking at this from an American perspective. From a Ukrainian perspective, I think that what Mr. Leshenko and others who were looking into the Black Ledger were most concerned about was actually not Mr. Manafort, but former President Yanukovych and his political party and the amount of money that they allegedly stole and where it went and so forth. I mean, I think there's just a difference in perspective depending on which country you're in.
But you can understand the president, at least from his perspective, looking at these facts, it certainly is reasonable to conclude that there are elements of the Ukrainian establishment that are advocating against them at this point in time, correct?
Well, you know, just speaking about Mr. Leshenko, he's an investigative journalist, as you said, and he got access to the Black Ledger, and he published it, as I think journalists would do. And again, I'm not sure I don't have any information to suggest that that was targeting President Trump.
With the way the events unfolded, Mr. Manafort was, you know, subsequently left the campaign, and it certainly did begin a period of interest in, you know, Manafort's ties to Russia and so forth.
I think, again, I think that that may have been the effect here in the United States. And obviously, it was of interest to journalists and others here that Mr. Manafort was former President Yanukovych's political advisor, and he was the political advisor, head of a campaign here. And so we all know that there have been court cases and so forth where Mr. Manafort was found guilty of certain actions. But at the end of the day, President Trump won the elections.
With Mr. Leshenko's reporting, I mean, there's been a question of whether all the information that he published was authentic, correct?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
There's been some have questioned whether the information Mr. Leshenko published was all correct or whether it was doctored.
Okay, I wasn't aware of that.
Okay. You know, Ambassador Chali, during the August timeframe, he wrote an op-ed in The Hill taking issue with then-candidate Trump. Were you aware of that when it occurred?
Yes.
And did you have any communications with the ambassador to express concerns?
No.
And how frequently did you communicate with with the ambassador. Obviously, you're in different posts in different countries, but
yeah, didn't actually see him or talk to him that often.
So you weren't in frequent communication?
No.
Can you see how, you know, writing an op-ed, even, you know, given the substance, you know, we've discussed the substance of it, that there's sensitivities, but can you see how just the simple fact of writing an op-ed, the Ukrainian ambassador to the U.S., might create a perception that there are elements of the Ukrainian establishment that were advocating against then-Canada Trump?
My recollection of the of that op-ed was that he was taking a he was critical of a policy position that President Trump had with regard to Crimea and whether Crimea was you know, a part of Ukraine or a part of Russia. That's a tremendously sensitive issue in Ukraine, and my recollection is that that is what Ambassador Chali was writing about.
And do you know whether the ambassador or anybody from the embassy tried to make contact with the Trump camp to talk about their concerns before lodging an op-ed?
I don't know.
Okay. You know, during the same time period of the run-up to the election, the Minister Avakov had said some especially candid things about then-candidate Trump on some various social media platforms. Are you aware of that?
Yes, as a result of the deposition, okay. The previous deposition.
But during the relevant time period when it was happening, you weren't aware of that?
I don't recall it.
Okay. He's one of the more influential officials in the Ukraine, correct?
He is.
I believe he's one of the few that spanned both the Poroshenko administration and the Zelensky administration.
Yes, that's correct.
Looking back on his comments in hindsight, do you see how that might create a perception that a very influential Ukrainian was you know, advocating against then-candidate Trump?
That he was doing what? I'm sorry?
Just advocating. He was out to get him. I mean, he said some real nasty things.
Well, you know, sometimes that happens on social media. And are you asking me whether it's appropriate? Probably not. But I would say that Minister Avakov has been, as well as others, both in President Poroshenko's administration as well as in the Zelensky administration, has been a good partner to the United States. As I think I told you before, he's a very practical man and looking for partners and getting the job done.
I'm shocked that social media would be the site of negative comments. You certainly can understand that the president, aware of Minister Avakov's, you know, statements, aware of what Mr. Leshenko was up to, what Ambassador Chali was up to, and these other elements that we've discussed, that there certainly forms a reasonable basis to wonder whether there are influential, elements of the Ukrainian establishment that were out to get the president.
I can't speak for what President Trump thought or what others thought. I would just say that those elements that you've recited don't seem to me to be the Ukrainian, you know, kind of a plan or a plot of the Ukrainian government to work against President Trump or anyone else. I mean, they're isolated incidents. Mm-hmm. We all know, I'm coming to find out myself, that public life can be, you know, people are critical. And that does not mean that someone is, or a government is undermining either a campaign or interfering in elections. And I would just remind again that our own U.S. intelligence community has conclusively determined that the those who interfered in the election were in Russia.
Mm-hmm. You would turn our attention to Ambassador Volker. He's been a friend and colleague of yours for many years. Is that correct?
Yes, that's true.
And I believe you testified he's a man of honor.
I believe that to be true.
And a brilliant diplomat.
Yes.
And you have no reason to think that he would be undertaking any initiative that was counter to U.S. interests?
I think that he tried to do what he thought was right.
Turning our attention to the Trump administration's policy of aid, the aid package to Ukraine, you've testified that during your tenure as ambassador, America's policy actually got stronger toward Ukraine. Is that accurate?
With the provision of javelins to the Ukrainian military, yes, that was really positive.
And why was that important?
Well, two things. They are obviously tank busters, and so if the war with Russia all of a sudden accelerated in some way and tanks come over the horizon, javelins are a very serious weapon to deal with that. That's number one. But really the more important issue is the symbolism of it, that the United States is providing javelins to Ukraine. That makes Ukraine's adversaries think twice.
And the provision of javelins to Ukraine was blocked during the previous administration. Is that correct?
I think they made a determination. I was not a part of those discussions, but obviously they had not yet made a determination about whether to provide javelins.
But do you have any understanding of what the interagency consensus was with regard to javelins during the previous administration?
I think that most in the interagency wanted to provide javelins to Ukraine.
And so in the new administration under President Trump, the ability to afford Ukraine this weaponry is a significant advantage, significant step forward?
We thought it was important.
And has it played out that way?
Well, it has,
because
it's a symbol of our strong support for Ukraine. But when then, this year there are questions as to whether or not our security assistance is going to go through, that kind of undermines that strong message of support.
Ukraine still has the ability to acquire the javelins, though, correct?
Are you now talking about purchasing javelins
purchasing.
By the Ukrainian government?
Yeah.
Yeah, they do.
And
that is my understanding.
And the security sector assistance did go through. It was paused for 55 days from July 18th to September 11th, but it ultimately went through, correct?
It's my understanding.
Okay. You testified during your deposition that you were proud of the efforts of the United States during your tenure to, supply this type of aid to Ukraine. Are you still happy with the decisions?
Are you talking about the javelin?
The javelin, and also the whole aid package.
Yes.
Do you think it's sufficient? Do you think we're giving Ukraine enough money?
That's a hard question, because one can always use additional funding. That said, I think that that the Congress has been very generous in voting for security assistance and other forms of assistance for Ukraine.
See, my time is coming to an end, Mr. Chairman.
Thank the gentleman. We'll now go to member five-minute rounds. I recognize myself for 5 minutes. Ambassador Yovanovitch, I want to follow up on some of the questions from my colleagues. Some of the early questions seem to suggest that your testimony here was completely irrelevant to the issues at hand. Why are you even here? Isn't this just some small matter that should have been referred to HR? So I want to bring our attention to someone who thought you were actually very important to this whole plot or scheme, and that is the President of the United States. There was only one ambassador, I believe, who was discussed by the President in the July 25th call, and that was you, Ambassador Yovanovitch. And I want to refer back to how you were brought up in that conversation. At one point during the conversation, the President brings up this prosecutor who was very good and it was shut down, and that's really unfair. And I think you indicated earlier that that was a likely reference to Mr. Lutsenko, the corrupt prosecutor. Is that right?
I believe that is the case, but I don't know.
So immediately after the president brings up this corrupt former prosecutor, only one American ambassador is brought up in the call. Immediately after the president brings up this corrupt prosecutor that he praises and says he was treated very unfairly, he then encourages Zelensky to speak with Giuliani, the guy who orchestrated the smear campaign against you, correct?
Yes.
And he then brings you up. So he praises the corrupt prosecutor. He says, I want you to talk to Giuliani, the guy who smeared you. And then he brings you up. He obviously thought you were relevant to this. But what is even more telling is immediately after he brings you up and says that you, the woman, was bad news, he says, there's a lot to talk about Biden's son, that Biden stopped the prosecution, and a lot of people want to find out about that. So whatever you can do with the attorney general would be great. Immediately after praising this corrupt prosecutor, he attacks you, and then he goes right to Biden. That would indicate to you, wouldn't it, Ambassador, that he connects you somehow with this prosecutor you were at odds with and his desire to see this investigation of Biden go forward, would it not?
Again, you're absolutely right that that is the thought progression.
My colleagues also asked, in pushing you out of the way, mm-hmm. ultimately Ambassador Taylor got appointed. Is Ambassador Taylor the kind of person that would further Giuliani's aims? And I think we can all agree that Ambassador Taylor is a remarkable public servant.
Absolutely.
But what if the president could put someone else in place that wasn't a career diplomat? What if he could put in place, say, a substantial donor to his inaugural? What if he could put in place someone with no diplomatic experience at all? What if he could put in place someone whose portfolio doesn't even include Ukraine? Might that person be willing to work with Rudy Giuliani in pursuit of these investigations?
Yeah, maybe.
That's exactly what happened, wasn't it?
Yes.
Now, my colleagues also say, well, the security assistance ultimately went through. So if they sought to condition or bribe Ukraine into doing these investigations by withholding security assistance, they ultimately paid the money. Are you aware, Ambassador, that the security assistance was not released until after a whistleblower complaint made its way to the White House?
Yes, I'm aware of that.
Are you aware that it was not released until Congress announced it was doing an investigation?
Yes, I'm aware of that.
And finally, I want to ask you about the call record that my colleague read at the outset. I'm curious about this. And just for people watching at home so they're not confused, there are two calls here. There's the perfunctory congratulatory call after Zelensky is inaugurated, which my ranking member read this morning. And then there's, of course, the very problematic call in July. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons we are here is what happened between April and July. But there was a readout put out by the White House at the time the April congratulatory call was made. And the White House readout said that the president discussed with Zelensky helping Ukraine root out corruption. Now, that, in fact, doesn't appear anywhere in that call. So I want to ask you, Ambassador, why would the White House put out an inaccurate reading? Why would the White House represent that the president said something about corruption when he said nothing about corruption in that call or, in fact, in the one in July?
I can't answer that question. I don't have visibility into that.
I thank you. I yield now 5 minutes now to recognize the ranking member.
Ambassador, I just want to clarify something before I yield. Are you against political appointed ambassadors? Is it not the president's prerogative to appoint whoever he wants in any country?
First of all, I am not against political ambassadors, I just wanted to clear
that up.
Mr. Himes, you're recognized.
Ambassador, when you're ambassador somewhere, do you have the right to ask the intelligence community, the CIA in an embassy, what operations they're doing?
We talk about these things collaboratively. There's some things that, in short, yes.
So you have the right to ask the intelligence community in your embassy what they're doing. Why might you do that?
Because sometimes operations have political consequences.
Right. So the performance of your duties in the interests of the United States gives you the right to ask very sensitive questions of our intelligence community in your embassy. But what if instead of working through the issues that you just described, you went to dinner that night and handed over that information to a Russian agent for $10,000? Would that be an appropriate exercise of your right?
No, it would not.
It would not. And what would happen to you if you did that?
Well, I can't even begin to imagine, but I would imagine that I would be pulled out of post.
So I guess the question is, why, after an exemplary performance as ambassador to Ukraine, did the president decide that you should be removed? Because I think we just agreed that if that was not done in the national interest, that's a problem. Ambassador, if you had remained ambassador to Ukraine, would you have recommended to the president of the United States that he asked the new Ukrainian president to investigate, and I'm quoting from the transcript here, CrowdStrike or the server?
No, I would repeat once again that the U.S. intelligence community has concluded that it was the Russians.
Okay. So, Ambassador, if you had remained as ambassador and not been summarily dismissed, would you have supported a three-month delay in congressionally mandated military aid to Ukraine?
No.
Ambassador, if you had remained as ambassador of Ukraine, would you have recommended to the president that he ask a new president of Ukraine to, quote, find out about Biden's son?
No.
Mr. Conaway.
Lots been said about what was going on around the phone call. I'd like to focus more on what's happened since then to you and your career and what's going on. So when you got the word, anytime a ambassador changes post, there's a process you go through to depict what you do next. And that happened in this instance. Can you give us a quick statement as to how what happened when you came back here as to what your next assignment would be at State?
So when I came back, obviously it was sort of out of cycle. There was nothing set up.
Sure.
And again, I am grateful that Deputy Secretary Sullivan asked me what I would like to do next. I recalled that there was the fellowship at Georgetown and asked whether that might be something that could be arranged.
Was that your only choice?
I'm not sure. We didn't really discuss other options.
My sense is Georgetown is fertile ground for State Department recruitment of future fledgling Foreign Service officers. And so they now benefit from your experience and your inspiration to inspire them to have spend their professional life in service to our nation.
Thank you.
You're a fellow there. You teach classes. How many classes do you teach?
Well, this semester I was supposed to teach two. I am still teaching one on national security. The other one was on Ukraine, and I asked whether I could,
defer on that. How many students in your class? Approximately.
There are, I think 14, 15.
Right. Any other responsibilities as state other than the fellowship at Georgetown?
Well, I will tell you that all of this has kept me very busy.
Okay, I got that. But no necessarily day-to-day things that you'd be responsible for. Other than not qualifying for overseas stipends and other things, has your compensation been affected by being recalled the way you were?
No, it has not.
Okay. I'm worried about the way you might be treated by your fellow employees at State. any negative? Are they hold you in less high regard than they used to as a result of this? Do they shun you at the lunch counter? Or do they treat you badly as a result of the way you were treated by the president?
I've actually received an outpouring of support.
Okay.
From my colleagues.
So the folks that you respect the most still respect you and appear to hold you in high regard and high affection?
They do.
Okay. George Kent was in here a couple of days ago. He made some exemplary statements about you, really glowing. All of us, I think, would like to be the recipient of something that worthy, and I believe you are as well. Any reason on earth that you can think of that George Kent would be saying that because of some reason other than the fact that he believes it in his heart of hearts?
Like what?
Well, I mean, like somebody paid him to do it.
Oh, no, absolutely.
Okay, so
not.
You and I agree that we think he was sincere in that bragging on you, and that's all post the recall episode that's been much of the discussion this morning.
Ms. Sewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ambassador, in your prior testimony, you spoke so movingly about your family background. You stated that your parents fled communist and Nazi regimes, and that they valued freedom and democracy offered in America, having experienced totalitarian regimes. Did that have any effect on your desire to enter into the United States Foreign Service?
Yes, it did.
Did you always know that you wanted to be in the Foreign Service? I look at your background, and it is perfectly suited for what you're doing. I note that you studied at the Pushchinsky State Russian Language Institute in Russia to learn Russian.
Yeah.
That you have do you also have an MS from the National Defense University National War College?
Yes.
I even noticed that you earned your undergraduate degree in history and Russian studies in college, and coincidentally, that was also my college. And you definitely are doing Princeton and the nation's service by what you do every day. But I really want to know how it felt to have your reputation sullied, not for state and nation, but for personal gain. You spoke about how your service is not just your own personal service, it affects your family. And today we've seen you as this former ambassador, this 33-year veteran of the Foreign Service, but I want to know about you personally and how this has affected you personally and your family.
Yeah. It's been a difficult time. I mean, I'm a private person. I don't want to put all that out there. But it's been a very, very difficult time because the president does have the right to have his own or her own ambassador in every country in the world.
But does the president have the right to actually malign people's character? I mean, it may not be against any law, but I would think that it would be against decorum and decency.
I mean, there's a question as to why the kind of campaign to get me out of Ukraine happened, because all the president has to do is say he wants a different ambassador. And in my line of work, perhaps in your line of work as well, all we have is our reputation. And so this has been a very painful period.
How has it affected your family?
I really don't want to get into that, but Okay. Thank you for asking.
Because I do care. I also want to know how you think it affected your fellow colleagues in the Foreign Service. My Republican colleagues have said that since you received such adulation from and embracing from your own fellow colleagues, that what occurred, the incident that occurred with the president and his cronies, you know, maligning your reputation, how has that had a chilling effect on the ability and the morale within the Foreign Service? Can you speak to that?
Yeah. I think that it has had exactly that, a chilling effect, not only in Embassy Kyiv, but throughout the State Department, because people don't know whether their efforts to pursue our stated policy are going to be supported. And that is a dangerous place to be.
Now, for the record, my Republican colleagues will probably try to paint you as a never-Trumper. Are you a never-Trumper?
No.
As a Foreign Service officer, you took an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States without regard for who's in office. Is that correct?
Yes, that's true.
Have you also served in your 33 years for not just Democratic presidents, but also Republican presidents? For Republican presidents. In fact, you joined the Foreign Service under Reagan. Is that not right?
Yes, that's true.
Now, why do you think it's really important that Foreign Service officers are nonpartisan? Can you talk to us about why it's important for you to do your job and your fellow Foreign Service officers to do your job that you're nonpartisan?
Yeah, because our work is essentially nonpartisan. And, you know, Senator Vandenberg, a Republican senator who actually partnered with President Truman, coined a phrase that politics should stop at the water's edge. And I think that's exactly right, because while obviously the competition of ideas in a democracy with different parties, different individuals, is hugely important, but at the end of the day, when we are dealing with other countries, it needs to be about what is right for the United States. Those are our national security interests. And whether an individual works for the CIA or the military or the State Department, we've got to be nonpartisan and thinking about what is right for the United States.
Well, on behalf of a grateful nation, well, I want to say thank you for your service. I yield back the balance of my time.
Thank you.
Mr. Turner. I know you have little access directly to decision makers, little resources, but you have still a great deal of responsibility. It's a complex task, and I want to take us from just the concept of one-dimensional Ukraine being corrupt to the other issues that you had to deal with as the Ukraine ambassador. You had to deal with more than just our bilateral relationship with Ukraine, for example. And I'd like confirmation that, I mean, obviously I know you know these, but these were on your portfolio. You had to deal with the issue of the OSCE Budapest Agreement and the denuclearization of Ukraine and the issues of its territorial integrity of the signatories, correct?
Could you run that by me again?
The OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation for Europe, mm-hmm. and the Budapest Agreement, under which Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons and believed they had its territorial integrity guaranteed by the United States and Russia. Mm-hmm. You would have had that in your portfolio.
Well, that
was an issue you would have to deal with the Ukrainians on.
Yeah, when the Ukrainians would ask about our policy and whether it was in keeping with the Budapest Agreement.
Excellent. NATO. Ukraine is an aspiring NATO country. And, of course, you have the Bucharest summit where the U.S. and the NATO allies made a statement that they would get membership. That would have been on your portfolio. They would have been discussing with you.
Yes, certainly aspirations to NATO membership would
right.
be.
And it's also consistent with U.S. policy that the U.S. supports Ukraine joining the EU, and they have a great deal of interest and desire for joining the EU, correct?
Yes.
And they just had a summit in Ukraine in July where they talked about the associated agreement on economic integration between the Ukrainians and the EU. And they also had a discussion about the illegal annexation of Crimea and the blocking by Russia of the Ukrainian sailors that came out of the Azov Sea and that were captured. Those would have all been issues that would have been in your portfolio and that were consistent with what the EU's issues are, correct?
Yes. We work closely with our EU partners.
In addition to Ukraine, you'd have to work with France and UK and Germany, all of which you have different ideas of those. The ambassadors to the Ukraine of France, Germany, and the,
yeah.
correct?
Yeah. Did you say they all have different ideas about these issues?
Some of them, yes.
But mostly there's a consensus.
You'd have to work with NGOs, non-governmental organizations, on issues that we heard about, legal aid, human trafficking, building democratic institutions, and even HIV/AIDS, right?
Yes.
And you've spoken at several NGOs while you were the ambassador to Ukraine.
Yes.
Now, the U.S. ambassador to the EU, they would have under their portfolio aspiring nations to the EU, would they not?
Yeah.
Okay, so EU Ambassador Sondland then would have had Ukraine in his portfolio because they're an inspiring nation and he's our U.S. ambassador to the EU, correct?
I think he testified that one of his first discussions.
But you agree that it's within his portfolio, correct?
He was answering the question.
You would agree that it's in his portfolio, would you not? Yes.
I would agree.
Yes, thank you. Now, I want to go to the next
question. I'm sorry. Can you finish your answer,
Richard
please?
Holbrooke is a person who I have a great deal of reverence for.
Ambassador Ivanovich should not finish her answer. You may finish your answer, Ambassador.
Not out of my time. You're done.
Nope.
Right?
Ambassador? Ambassador will be recognized.
I would say that all EU ambassadors deal with other countries, including aspiring countries, but it is unusual to name the U.S. ambassador to the EU to be responsible for all aspects of Ukraine.
I'll take your additional answer. It's still in his portfolio, which was my question. You knew Ambassador Holbrooke, probably. I did. He's a man of great integrity, one of our most successful ambassadors. You know him probably by his reputation. You would agree that he was a man of great reputation, right?
Yes.
Yes. Madam Ambassador, would it surprise you if in 2004 John Kerry had a member of his campaign who was a foreign policy advisor who traveled to the Ukraine in July and met with Ukrainian officials and the U.S. ambassador? Would that surprise you? And a member of John Kerry's campaign team for President of the United States in 2004 traveled to Ukraine, met with the U.S. ambassador in July.
Not necessarily.
Would you have taken that meeting if a member of John Kerry's campaign traveled to the Ukraine? Would you have taken that meeting?
I guess it would depend on what the purpose of the meeting was.
Well, that meeting actually occurred, and it was with John Holbrooke. John Holbrooke was a private citizen, traveled to Ukraine, met with U.S. ambassadors, met with Ukrainian officials. He was also there on about HIV/AIDS, which was, in addition, something the Clinton Foundation was working on. So we have an official of the John Kerry campaign in 2004 as a private citizen meeting with our ambassador in Ukraine.
Time of the gentleman's expired.
Unusual.
We meet with private individuals all the time.
It probably wasn't unusual for Giuliani.
Gentlemen's time has expired. Mr. Carson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Madam Ambassador. Madam Ambassador, returning to the topic of corruption, we heard evidence that you were successful at promoting efforts to address corruption. On Wednesday, in testifying about your very sterling career as a champion of anti-corruption efforts in Ukraine, Deputy Assistant Secretary George Kent said, quote, "You can't promote principled anti-corruption action without pissing off corrupt people," end quote. It seems that your efforts as ambassador to essentially reform the powerful prosecutor general's office in Ukraine did exactly that. Madam Ambassador, what concerned you about the prosecutor general's office when you were the ambassador in Ukraine?
What concerned us was that there didn't seem to be any progress in the three overall objectives that Mr. Lutsenko had laid out, most importantly for the Ukrainian people, but also the international community. So the first thing was reforming the Prosecutor General's office. It's a tremendously powerful office where they had authority not only to conduct investigations, so an FBI-like function, but also to do the actual prosecution. So very, very wide powers, which is part of that Soviet legacy. And there just wasn't a lot of progress in that. There wasn't a lot of progress in handling personnel issues and how the structure should be organized and who should have the important jobs, because some of the people in those jobs were known to were considered to be corrupt themselves. Secondly, the issue that was tremendously important to the Ukrainian people of bringing justice to the over 100 people who died on the Maidan during the Revolution of Dignity in 2014. Nobody has been held accountable for that. And that is, you know, kind of an open wound for the Ukrainian people. And thirdly, Ukraine needs all the money that it has. And there is a strong belief that former President Yanukovych and those around him made off with over $40 billion. $40 billion, that's a lot in the U.S. It's a huge amount of money in Ukraine. And so, again, nobody has, none of that money has really been, I think maybe $1 billion was repatriated, but the rest of it is still missing.
Madam Ambassador, was the head of that office corrupt?
We believe so.
And you got the sense, did you not, that he was a driving force behind some of the attacks against you?
I did.
Which ultimately led to your removal, correct?
Yes.
But it wasn't just him. His allegations were picked up and spread by Mr. Giuliani and Donald Trump Jr., were they not?
Yes.
So let me get this straight. You are effective at fighting corruption in the Ukraine, fighting that corruption was important to the national security of the United States, and you were punished for that, ultimately being removed from your post by the President of the United States. So in your opinion, Madam Ambassador, why is it important to have a nonpartisan career in the Foreign Services?
I think it's important to have a nonpartisan career Foreign Service office, because what we do is inherently nonpartisan. It is about our national security interests. It's not about what is good for a particular party at a particular time. It has to be about the greater interests of our security in, frankly, what is an increasingly dangerous world.
And could you briefly describe for us what broad U.S. policies you have sought to advance in your 33 years of service, and specifically in post-Soviet states like Ukraine?
Well, that's a broad question. But I think that certainly in my time in Russia, Armenia, Kyrgyzstan, all of these countries are very different, as is Ukraine. I think that establishing positive, constructive relations to the extent that we can with those countries is really important. There are three basic areas. One is security, the second is economic, and the third is political. And so working all the sub-issues, your colleague mentioned many of them, we certainly did that in Ukraine as well.
Thank you for your service. I yield to the chairman.
Thanks.
Dr. Winstrup.
In your deposition on page 144, you're quoted as saying, in terms of lethal assistance, we all felt it was very significant that this administration made the decision to provide lethal weapons to Ukraine. Just real quick, who in general makes up we all? Would that be the team I mentioned?
Yeah, can I just look at that? Just one sec. What line is that?
Well, I have to move on. You said we all felt it was very significant that this administration made the decision to provide lethal weapons to Ukraine. I assume that is those that have boots on the ground. And then this administration, I assume you meant the Trump administration.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. In your deposition, also on page 144, you spoke about the generosity of Congress. You mentioned it today, increasing aid to Ukraine. And part of your deposition, after that statement that I quoted before, you were asked, did you advocate for that? You responded, yes. Then you were asked, did you advocate for that prior to the new administration in 2016? And you responded, well, yeah. On page 148, were you satisfied that the administration was doing what was necessary to support Ukraine? You said, in what respect? And they said, in helping them deter Russian aggression, helping them with foreign aid and foreign assistance. And you said, yeah. And I agree that lethal assistance was very significant, as you said. And I thank you for that. And I thank Mr. Volker, and I thank Mr. Taylor. The Acting Ambassador Taylor was here Wednesday. He testified about the president's decision to withhold lethal aid, and he said the president felt it might provoke Russia. And Mr. Taylor contested then that Russia has already been provoked and they have invaded the Ukraine. President Obama had the right to make his own foreign policy and make his own decisions as president of the United States, correct?
Yeah, there's an interagency process, and obviously Congress as well.
He has the right as president. I respect the interagency process. I'm getting to that, actually. But he has the right to make his own foreign policy and make his own decisions as president of the United States, as do all presidents, correct?
Yes.
So we have one president, Obama, who denied lethal aid altogether, in spite of ambassadors and other boots on the ground making that recommendation, such as you did. We have another president, Trump, who vetted those that were going to receive the aid and provided it consistent with your interagency recommendations and that of your colleagues. Let me just ask you, from a military standpoint, without javelins, would you agree the Russians had much greater military offensive options and flexibility in their effort to attack the Ukraine? without the Ukraine having javelins?
Yeah, I mean, they had another option, although the tank war is no longer the war that is being fought in Ukraine.
Yeah, but I'm just saying with the javelin.
Yeah, it's another option.
And there's a reason for that, because the javelins are there. And so I think that that changes the scenario. But I just wanted to make that point, that the president has a right to have their own foreign policy and to make their own decisions. And with that, I yield back.
Yeah. If I could just supplement one of my answers.
Of course.
So I want to thank you for your service as well. But what I'd like to say is, while I obviously don't dispute that the president has the right to withdraw an ambassador at any time for any reason. But what I do wonder is why it was necessary to smear my reputation.
Also. Well, I wasn't asking about that, but thank you very much, ma'am.
Representative Speer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ambassador, so very much. You were confirmed by the Senate on a voice vote, weren't you?
Yes.
So unanimous, Republicans and Democrats, correct?
Yes.
No dispute. You said that in summer of 2018, the smear campaign began in your testimony earlier today. Did Secretary Pompeo at any time come to your aid?
Well, my understanding from Assistant Secretary Phil Rieker and Deputy Secretary Sullivan is that, you know, this sort of the rumors about me, if, for lack of a better word, the smear campaign, which was behind closed doors at that point, that there were a number of discussions between the president and Secretary Pompeo, and that he actually did keep me in place for as long as he could. That's what I was told.
So it appears that back in 2018, the president was already making noises that he wanted you out of there. It appears that as early as April of 2018, Mr. Parnas was at a fundraiser for the president and recommended that you be removed. And then subsequently, in May of 2018, was pictured at a White House dinner with the president. And then later in May, made a contribution of over $325,000 illegally to the president's reelection campaign. Are you aware of that?
I'm aware of the press about those things.
Does that help you understand a little bit more why this smear campaign was underway?
Yes, I mean.
All right. You made some very riveting comments in your statement this morning that I just want to repeat, because I think we should have you expand on it. You said, "I've always understood that I served at the pleasure of the president. I still find it difficult to comprehend that foreign and private interests were able to undermine U.S. interests in this way. Individuals who apparently felt stymied by our efforts to promote stated U.S. policy against corruption, that is, to do our mission, were able to successfully conduct a campaign of disinformation against a sitting ambassador using unofficial back channels." Now, as I listened to you make that statement, I was thinking of all the other persons in the Foreign Service who now have to be concerned that it's not good enough to follow the stated U.S. foreign policy, but also to be aware that maybe the president has a back channel of interests that he is promoting that is diametrically opposed to our stated foreign policy. Can you expand on that, please?
Well, I think that it's important that whoever is representing the president, an ambassador, speaks with the full authority of the president and our foreign policy establishment. And if there are others who are also helping with the responsibilities in that country, for example, Ambassador Kurt Volker with his important mission to bring peace to the Donbass, that we all speak with one voice, that it's all about our common security interest, and that it's not about, you know, personal gain or commercial gain or anything else, that it's about our national security.
But in this case, the Tres Amigos appeared to be more interested in getting an investigation than into promoting an anti-corruption effort in Ukraine. Is that correct?
That appears to be the case.
You were told at one point in 2019, in February of earlier this year, you spoke to a minister in Ukraine who warned that when it came to Rudy Giuliani, you needed to, quote, watch your back. What did you understand him to mean?
I didn't exactly know, but, you know, the rumor was out there at that time. And, in fact, I think this minister also shared that information with me that the mayor was working to have me removed.
Mr. Stewart, you're recognized.
And with that statement, I would now feel compelled to ask you, Madam Ambassador, as you see it here before us, very simply and directly, do you have any information regarding the President of the United States accepting any bribes?
No.
Do you have any information regarding any criminal activity that the President of the United States has been involved with at all?
No.
Now, I want to ask you one thing very quickly, and you've been asked this again and again, but my question is slightly different. You've been asked, as you recognize, that the President, any President, has the ability to ask his ambassadors to serve at will. I'm curious, do you think that's the right policy?
Yeah, I probably think it is.
Would you agree, then, that it's appropriate to investigate corruption?
I think it's appropriate if it's part of our national strategy. What I would say is that we have a process for doing that. It's called the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty. We have one with Ukraine, and generally it goes from our Department of Justice to the Ministry of Justice in the country of interest.
Okay,
and that's the usual path.
And I appreciate that.
Mr. Quigley, you're recognized.
Madam Ambassador, it's like a Hallmark movie. You ended up at Georgetown. This is all okay. But it wasn't your preference 7-8 months ago, correct?
No, it was not.
Wasn't your preference to be the victim of a smear campaign, was it?
No.
Wasn't your preference to be defamed by the President of the United States, including today, was it?
No.
Wasn't your preference to be ousted at seemingly the pinnacle of your career, was it?
No.
You wanted to finish your extended tour, correct?
I did.
What did you want to do after that? Did you know?
I wasn't sure.
There's nothing wrong with Georgetown. It's a fine place, right?
It's a wonderful place.
But it's your only choice at the end of a distinguished career after all that. It's not the end of a Hallmark movie. It's the end of a really bad reality TV show brought to you by someone who knows a lot about that. Why did you previously testified that you sought advice from Ambassador Sondland at this time about what to do. Is that correct?
I did.
And why did you reach out to the ambassador?
Because this was clearly so political and was not going to be, you know, the State Department was not in a position, shall we say, to manage the issue. It didn't appear to me. And so I asked Ambassador Sondland, who said that he, you know, he was a political appointee. He said he was close to the president. And so he had just been in Ukraine for a ship visit with some of his EU colleagues from Brussels. And so I reached out to him for advice. When this was no longer a Ukraine kind of an interview with Mr. Lutsenko, kind of a Ukrainian, but it became sort of the American politicians and pundits, et cetera, were repeating those allegations, I asked him for advice.
And it meant a lot to you. This is an extraordinary time. And the advice meant a lot. And what was his advice?
Well, he suggested that I needed to go big or go home, and he said that the best thing to do would be to, you know, send out a tweet, praise the president, that sort of thing.
And what was your reaction to that advice?
Well, my reaction was that I'm sure he meant well, but it was not advice that I could really follow. It felt it felt partisan. It felt political, and I just that was not something that I thought was in keeping with my role as ambassador and a foreign service officer.
Did he give you any specific suggestions on what to say about the President of the United States, or just say something nice about him?
Yeah, just to praise him.
Thank you. I yield the balance to the chairman.
I want to follow up on Ms. Quigley's line of question and also harken back to something you were asked by Minority Counsel earlier. You were asked a couple of questions. Do you think you could have done more to push back against the smear campaign? I'm not suggesting this is what the counsel was getting at, but sometimes victims are asked, aren't you responsible for your own victimization? What would you say to people who say, isn't it kind of your fault, Ambassador, that you didn't fight your own smear harder?
Well, I think that, you know, I've been a Foreign Service officer for a long time. And just like the military, we have our own culture, we have our own kind of chain of command, so to speak. And I did everything that I could to address these issues and ask the State Department to do what I felt was the right thing, which was support me when it was important to do so, because it was also about supporting the policy. I think it was for others to stand up for me.
Mr. Swalwell.
But here, Ms. Yovanovitch, we are here to talk about you and what you witnessed. And you saw a lot as it related to Mr. Giuliani. And I want to read a quote to you from Mr. Giuliani, but first ask you, when you were in Ukraine, you understood that Rudy Giuliani was Donald Trump's personal lawyer. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Are you familiar with Rudy Giuliani's quote in the New York Times describing himself as the lawyer saying, quote, he basically knows what I'm doing, comma, sure, as his lawyer? Were you familiar with that quote?
It sounds familiar.
And you have a lawyer with you today, Ms. Yovanovitch, mm-hmm. And you understand that lawyers act on their client's behalf, is that right?
Yes.
That it would be improper for a lawyer to go outside any directive that a client gives. Is that right?
That's my understanding.
Are you familiar with a New York Times story on May 9, 2019, where Rudy Giuliani says that he intends to visit Ukraine and says, we're not meddling in an election, we're meddling in an investigation? Are you familiar with that quote?
Yes.
That's 11 days before you were removed as ambassador. Is that right?
Yes.
He is talking publicly about designs on coming to Ukraine. But what I think is interesting is that Mr. Giuliani says, we're, as in we are. He doesn't say, I am not meddling in an election. He doesn't say, I'm not meddling in an investigation. He says, we. He's speaking for himself and his client. And I want to talk about that quote, we're not meddling in an election, we're meddling in an investigation. Is it proper for you or anyone who acts on behalf of the United States government to meddle in an investigation?
No, I don't believe so.
Why not?
Well, there are law enforcement channels, and things need to be handled properly and without any kind of political bias.
Now, this anti-corruption crusader, President Trump, who my colleagues have touted out as having such a great interest in anti-corruption, and both the calls that have been referenced today, the August 21 call and the July 25 call, isn't it true that President Trump never mentions the word corruption?
Yes, that's true.
Mr. Hurd.
Now, I'm nervous about what I'm getting ready to do. I want to do a five-year history of Ukraine in about 45 seconds. And now that you're a professor, you can grade my paper, okay? Valentine's Day 2014, the Ukrainian people get fed up with the Ukrainian president Yanukovych and basically overthrow him. He goes on the run. This was the revolution of dignity. Who was the acting president during that time when Yanukovych went out?
I think it was...
Churchinov, is that how you say it?
Churchinov, thank you for helping me.
Churchinov, okay, excellent. Then in March of 2014, that is when we saw little green men coming into Ukraine, and ultimately the Russians invade the Ukraine and not only try to annex Crimea, but also they invade the entire country in the eastern Donbass as well.
Yes.
Then there was an election, and the Ukrainian president was Poroshenko. That was in June of 2014. Then you came to post in 2016 of August. Is that correct?
2 years later.
January 2017, Trump was elected. And in December of 2017 is when the javelins were approved, mm-hmm. right? And we saw those javelins delivered in April of 2018 to be put to first use. Then we had Zelensky elected in 2019, April, mm-hmm. correct? Mm-hmm. Now, the Zelensky defeated the previous president, Poroshenko.
Yes.
There's no love lost between those two dudes, is there?
I don't think so.
Okay. And then in May of 2019, Zelensky is sworn in.
Yes.
So my questions, we talk a lot about Rudy Giuliani. Do we know what officials within the Zelensky regime he actually met with? I know two. A gentleman named by Yermak, who was one of Zelensky's senior advisors. And then we also know of the former attorney general that we've already established here, was corrupt, Lushenko.
All
right. And Mr. Lushenko served under Zelensky for a couple of months, up until August, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
And their parliament basically voted him out, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
So if Rudy Giuliani is trying to influence the Zelensky regime, would a guy that worked under the previous regime, under Poroshenko, be the right guy to do it?
So are you saying Mr. Lutsenko?
Yes.
That he could you could,
so
could you
did Mr. Lutsenko have much credibility within the Zelensky regime, the current regime?
I don't think so.
He didn't. Now, Mr. Yermak, do you know of any other Ukrainians that Mr. Giuliani was meeting with that was part of the Zelensky regime?
Well, just to remind, I would have already have left Ukraine by that point.
But
I'm not aware.
Even with the administration to come, right? Zelensky won the election. There was a two-month period of preparing to be installed as president. Even during that time, were you aware of any contact?
There is one of the oligarchs, as we've heard about. One of the oligarchs is named Mr. Kolomoisky, and he met with Mr. Fruman and Mr. Parnas, was apparently to get a meeting for Mr. Giuliani.
But those are not people that were actually in government or became in the Zelensky regime. Is that correct?
No.
Mr. Castro, in all of your years of service, have you ever come across a president, been asked by a president, or known of colleagues who were asked by an American president to help that president get an American investigated overseas?
I'm not aware of that.
And if a president asked you to investigate a former vice president for this purpose, what would you have said?
I mean, with what I know today, I would have said no.
And would you have considered an unlawful act?
I don't know that it's unlawful per se, but I think, again, that there are channels for conducting proper investigations, and that that would have been the best way to handle something like this.
But certainly it would be, it's bizarre for a president to ask that some American be investigated by another government.
It's very unusual.
And also, you mentioned that there is corruption in Ukraine. Ukraine isn't the only country that that confronts corruption. If the people in power in a country where corruption is rampant are being asked by a foreign leader who's got a lot of leverage over them to conduct an investigation, could that be dangerous because they could trump up charges against someone if they wanted?
They could.
And I also want to ask you, I spoke to Ambassador Kent. He made a comment yesterday about selective prosecutions and what it means going forward, what kind of precedent it sets. And you've spoken about a dangerous precedent for the State Department and for diplomats. But I want you to help us consider the precedent going forward. If there's no consequences for President Trump, or really any president who does this, what are the consequences for this country and for any American, not just a former vice president or a presidential candidate or even somebody in politics, but a person in business who does business in Saudi Arabia or some other country? If a president is going to speak to another head of state or some foreign official and try to get that person investigated, what does that mean for the future of the country and for Americans?
Well, I think that investigations, prosecutions, judicial decisions properly should remain with investigators, prosecutors, and the courts. And I think that, as I said before, I think Senator Vandenberg, when he said that politics needs to stop at the water's edge, I think he was right in that.
Mr. Ratcliffe.
I'd like to ask you about your earlier testimony about your Senate confirmation, and Congresswoman Stefanik had asked you how the Obama-Biden State Department had prepared you to answer questions about Burisma and Hunter Biden specifically. You recall that?
Yes.
And
yes.
She mentioned that you had been asked or been prepared for a question about Hunter Biden's role on the board of Burisma, but I don't think that you gave us the answer or answers that the Obama-Biden State Department prepared you to give in response to that question. Do you remember what those answers were?
Yeah. It was something along the lines of, I would refer you to the vice president's office on that.
So did they, in the course of that, brief you about the amount of money that Hunter Biden was being paid by Burisma?
No. This wasn't part of a briefing. I mean, I had sort of big old books with
right.
questions that might come up.
In preparation for your confirmation. And they thought that Hunter Biden's role at Burisma might be significant enough that it would come up during your confirmation. Is that correct?
Apparently so. I mean, there were hundreds of questions.
Well, hundreds of questions, but were there hundreds of companies? How many companies other than Burisma did the Obama-Biden State Department prepare you to give answers for? And if so, if there were others, which ones?
I just don't recall.
You don't recall that there were any other companies, is that correct?
I'm quite sure there probably were some companies, but I mean, you know, this is a while ago, and I don't recall.
But you specifically recall Burisma?
Yes.
All right. Out of thousands of companies in the Ukraine, the only one that you recall the Obama-Biden State Department preparing you to answer questions about was the one where the vice president's son was on the board. Is that fair?
Yes.
You understood from Deputy Assistant Secretary George Kent's testimony, as it's been related to you, that he testified a few days ago. Do you understand that that arrangement, Hunter Biden's role on the Burisma board, caused him enough concern that, as he testified in his statement, that in February of 2015, I raised my concern that Hunter Biden's status as a board member could create the perception of a conflict of interest And he went on to talk about the vice president's responsibilities over the Ukraine and, or over Ukrainian policy as one of those factors. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Did you ever, do you agree with that?
Yeah.
That it was a legitimate concern to raise?
I think that it could raise the appearance of a conflict of interest.
And did you discuss that ever with Mr. Kent?
I don't believe so.
Shortly before your confirmation in August of 2016, Prosecutor General Shokin was fired by President Poroshenko, correct?
Yes.
And Prosecutor General Shokin was the one who had opened the investigation into Burisma, correct?
I think that's right, but I'm not actually sure.
He was in charge of it, at least at that point in time, as the Prosecutor General.
Mm-hmm.
And are you aware of the very public statements by the Vice President that that firing of the Prosecutor General occurred in March of 2016, 6 hours after the Vice President told President Poroshenko that he needed to fire the Prosecutor General or that he wouldn't receive $1 billion from the United States? Do you recall that?
Yes.
All right. And do you think that that raises a potential concern or conflict of interest that the Vice President of the United States was ordering the firing of the prosecutor in charge of a company that has been identified as one that is substantially corrupt?
I actually don't. I don't think that the view that Mr. Shokin was not a good prosecutor general fighting corruption, I don't think that had anything to do with the Burisma case.
Nobody goes and talks to him and tells him to knock it off. Did you have any conversations, Ambassador, with Victoria Nuland or Secretary of State Perry about what was going on in 2016 and this majority of Ukrainian politicians being for candidate Clinton and not and opposed to President Trump?
No, I did not.
No one did anything. No one did anything. You see why maybe the president was a little concerned about what went on in Ukraine, and you couple that with the corruption level that we know exists in Ukraine, you add to that this idea that he's not a big fan of foreign aid, why he might be a little concerned about sending the hard-earned tax dollars of the American people to Ukraine?
You know, I can't speak for the president on this, but what I would say is you've listed a number of actions. I think from my point of view, that doesn't create a Ukrainian government strategy to interfere in our election.
I didn't say that.
Mr. Jordan, please allow the ambassador to answer the question.
So I would just say that, you know, U.S. politicians will often criticize policies of foreign counterparts, even perhaps during their elections. You know, this happens in politics, and I think that it doesn't necessarily constitute interference.
Would you ever write an op-ed,
Jordan, your time
critical
expired.
Of a presidential
Jordan,
candidate in Ukraine?
Jordan, your time has expired. Mr. Welch, you're recognized.
Mr. Sondland's transcript is out, and he was someone who indicated that everything hinged the White House meeting and the release of the vital defensive aid, everything hinged on the President Zelensky being willing to do that investigation that would benefit the Trump campaign. You're aware of that?
Yes.
And you've indicated that's something that you would not agree to do?
Yes.
And Sondland was quite willing to do?
Apparently so.
I thank you for your professional service.
Mr. Maloney.
I want to ask you about the day you were let go. And I know this is a painful series of events, so forgive me, but I think it's very important. It's April 24th, and you told us a few things that really stuck with me. You said you were at the embassy in Ukraine, you were honoring a Ukrainian woman, an anti-corruption activist. I believe her name is Katerina Handzyuk. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Am I saying that correctly?
Mm-hmm. I was at my house.
You were at your house, excuse me. Mm-hmm. And you were giving her the Woman of Courage Award, I believe.
Yeah, the Embassy Kyiv's Woman of Courage Award.
Right. And of course, that's the day you get a call from Carol Perez, a senior member of the Foreign Service. Did you know Carol Perez?
Yes.
You're both senior women in the Foreign Service. You had an opportunity to meet her before?
Yes.
And she says there's trouble coming. I want to give you a heads up. Correct me if I get this wrong. And I don't know a lot, but it's coming from the White House. I'll call you later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sums it up.
But you're literally that evening honoring this anti-corruption activist. Is that right?
Yes.
And not just any woman, but a woman who was, you said, horribly attacked and killed for her efforts. And she wasn't just killed. You said I believe that someone threw acid on her.
That's correct.
And I went and I checked during the break, and it turns out she was horribly injured, and it took 4 months for her to die. Is that right?
A very painful death.
Why would somebody attack her with acid? There are easier ways to kill people. Why do you think they did it with acid?
Well, I think they wanted her out of the way, but I think the message was this could happen to you, too, if you continue her work.
That's what happens when you go up against corrupt people in Ukraine.
It is something that can happen. I mean, there are other ways of sidelining people.
Do you remember speaking at that event?
I do.
I went and looked at what you said. You said, Katerina paid the ultimate price for her fearlessness in fighting against corruption and for her determined efforts to build a democratic Ukraine. Do you remember saying that?
Yes.
And then your phone rings, and you hear this trouble up the street. And Carol Perez called you back later that night, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was 1 a.m., I believe.
Yes.
Were you sleeping?
No.
You had stayed up?
Yes.
To get the phone call?
Yes.
And that's when she says two things, I believe, that really stuck with me. She said, we're worried about your security.
Yes.
You've just been honoring a woman who was killed for fighting for her anti-corruption efforts. And she says, you got to get on the next plane. Was she speaking euphemistically, get on the next plane, you know, when you get time? Did she mean literally the next plane?
Well, I think she meant, you know, as soon as possible. But pretty much it was the next plane.
And that's a pretty good flight back from Kyiv to Washington, and you're on your way to meet with Deputy Secretary Sullivan.
Yes.
And he says to you two things. He says there was a concerted effort against you, and he says you've done nothing wrong.
Right.
And what I'm fascinated about is when he says you've done nothing wrong, what did you expect the United States government would do next?
You know, it was pretty clear that a decision had been made by the president, implemented by the State Department, that I had to leave Ukraine. I had hoped that there would be more public support.
Did you expect them to have your back?
Yes.
And were you surprised when you found out they weren't gonna?
Not at that point anymore.
Why?
Well, because over the last several months, that had not been the case.
Ms. Demings.
And what message do you think it sends to other Foreign Service officers and public servants, which we so desperately need good ones, when an administration refuses to support its own officials in the face of a smear campaign?
Well, it's deeply troubling. It's deeply troubling, and there are morale issues at the State Department.
Morale issues at the State Department. I can understand why. On March 20th of 2019, President Trump tweeted an article that included a letter from Representative Pete Sessions that said you had, and I quote, spoken privately and repeatedly about your disdain for the current administration in a way that might call for the expulsion of you as U.S. ambassador to Ukraine immediately. Did you speak publicly and privately about your disdain for the Trump administration?
No.
Why do you think the president would want to push such a lie?
I don't know. I don't know.
I thank the gentlewoman. I'm going to go to Mr. Krishnamurthy.
In his opening statement, Ambassador Taylor said he took charge in Ukraine on June 17th.
Yes.
Therefore, there was almost a one-month gap between the time you departed and when Taylor took over, right?
Yes, yes.
During that time, on May 20th, Ambassador Sondland, Rick Perry, and others came to the inauguration of President Zelensky, right?
Yes.
And during that gap in time, Ambassador Sondland visited the White House, along with others, and got directions from President Trump to talk to Rudy. Those were his words. Talk to Rudy about what to do in Ukraine, right?
That's my understanding.
In other words, isn't it the case that your departure and the one-month gap between the time you left and when Ambassador Taylor arrived provided the perfect opportunity for another group of people to basically take over Ukraine policy? Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Ambassador, you're going to have to speak a little louder into the mic.
Yes, yes.
Thank you. On page 10 of your opening statement, you mentioned, quote unquote, corrupt interests apparently hijacking our Ukraine policy, right?
Yes.
A couple of suspect individuals in that regard were Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, right?
Yes.
You mentioned in response to Minority Counsel earlier that you learned that Fruman and Parnas were attempting to open a liquefied natural gas company, correct?
Yes.
How did you learn that, by the way?
I heard it from the Minister of Interior.
Interestingly, at noon today, the Wall Street Journal reported that federal prosecutors in Manhattan are investigating whether Rudy Giuliani stood to personally profit from that liquefied natural gas venture. Do you have any knowledge of that?
No, I do not.
Maybe we should talk to Rudy, huh? Ambassador, I'd like to direct you to another line of questioning that I had for Ambassador Taylor earlier this week. He said that there were irregular channels of diplomacy at work in Ukraine, circumventing normal diplomatic channels and threatening American interests in favor of private interests. I asked him the question, can you rule out the possibility that these irregular channels of diplomacy are being used in other countries where we conduct foreign policy? In response, he said that he could not rule it out. Ambassador Yovanovitch, I ask you, and I assume that you can't rule it out either, correct?
I can't, but I would also add I have no knowledge of that.
I understand. Are you concerned that these irregular channels of diplomacy may be at work elsewhere?
I think it's a possibility.
You testified that it was a, quote unquote, dangerous precedent that private interests and people who don't like a particular ambassador could combine to replace that ambassador. Are you concerned that other ambassadors may suffer the same fate as you?
Yes.
Ambassador, in your service as an American diplomat, you have encountered various dictators and strong men ruling other countries, right?
Yes.
In your personal life, your parents fled the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany, and they became familiar with despots and dictators as well, correct?
Yes.
Indeed, you're an authority on authoritarianism, right?
Well, maybe.
Is it a feature of authoritarianism to allow corrupt interests to hijack foreign policy?
Yeah.
Is it a feature of authoritarianism for the rulers there to claim absolute rights?
Yes.
And is it a hallmark of authoritarianism for those rulers to smear their opponents?
Sometimes, yes.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you haven't yet, please get on Facebook and Twitter and tell your friends and followers about the Lawfare podcast and give us a rating and review wherever you listen to us. You can also purchase Lawfare swag at www.thelawfarestore.com. This episode was edited by me, Elena Kagan. And until next time, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.